I started this morning, and there's a lot of fascinating things going on. It's the aftermath of some fascinating interactions that here Eliezer's mission has just taken place and has just started to be successful. And he now has to bring it to the next stage. And just as a general concept behind what's going on, it's fascinating to see some of the discussions that surround the Saliyah, because they impact both the understanding of what's happening and also some halachic implications. The Sfarim that talk about the Parsha in a halachic sense, when they talk about Parsha's Chayisaris, one of the topics that they focus on is the concept of Shlichus L'Kedushin, which is kind of correlated to our general topics this year. But it goes to a number of questions. It goes to the question as to what exactly was the mission of Eliezer. Was he a shadchan, or was he a shliach? Is he there to find the right person for Yitzchak and then prayer? Or was he there actually to go further than that and affect conclusion on behalf of Yitzchak, actually serving him? And you can find, you can read some of these parts that focus on halachic topics, parshas, popular discussions, parshas. Many of them derive certain halachic principles of Ashlichus Kedushin from the psukim in this week's parsha, from actions that Eliezer takes, statements that he makes. It's a fascinating idea in general, just how far we can go in deriving halachic principles from stories in Tanakh, especially because Eliezer presumably is not Jewish, so the idea that he's teaching us halachas about not only Kedushin, but Shlichus Kedushin, very interesting concept. But keep that in mind, as we see that's the theme that's going to display itself as we look at these psukim. So first off, he's very happy about what he has turned up here. And the Aliyah begins, Vayomer Baruch Hashem, Elokei Adonai Avraham, Hashem Azam, Paschal, Kanitzo, Adonai, Anochi Derech, Ani Hashem, Beisachai Adonai. So he is blessing God for how this worked out. And in the Sefer Kech, he actually brings that this is the source of the Matbea of Brachos. So what does that mean, the Matbea of Brachos? 13, one quotes this. And he understands that it means Sheva Malchus. Now that's interesting because there's no Malchus here, as the Rekech himself notes, because he says Hashem has not yet revealed his Malchus. So far we have Baruch, we have the Shab, we don't have the Malchus. So how do we know that we ever need Malchus? Then anyone else who cares? Next to Atosis, Sachs Brachos, and the fame and phase that Kei Avraham is the correlate to Malchus. So he talks about Chasid El Kamito, about the relationship between Chasid and Emes, which is a concept which is more well known from Parshas Vayechi. And the interpretations in that context are probably different than what it means here. Here, if Shem Shem Fal Hirsch understands that it's a reference to the fact that the MS is not always so pleasant, and sometimes you have to choose between the Ches and the MS. So here, he's grateful that he has the right thing and the pleasant thing, the kind thing, all happening together. So he's very happy about the way things are going. And the next passage tells us, but Torah Tzadara, the gave me Sipa, Bora Ma'ila, she brought back to her mother's house. The next passage tells us that she had a brother, Ravan, Lavana, Ach, Bolshara Rivka, Ach, Shmuel Avan, the Yaris Lavana, Alaisha, Kutsa, Alaim. So here he comes out and he meets them and he sees the gifts. Okay, so let's skip a little bit. Should remember some of these topics. So he brings Eliezer in and he gives food. So if you look at Pasuk Lamed Gimel, this is an interesting discussion. They use some of the hall. So they put food in front of Eliezer to eat. The over lo achal ad yivim divarti barai. It says they're not going to eat until I. give them this food. And my student is they can't eat just yet. I have business to do first. So what's going on over there? So here, in the spirit of what I mentioned before, that there are all kinds of yukim being made, all kind of attention being paid to the behavior of Eliezer, what he can teach us. That he is functioning halachically. So there's one suggestion here that is acting as Ashkenazi Jew, because Rav Yitzchak of Berdichev has a fascinating comment here that why is it that Eliezer declines to eat till after he takes care of what he has to do? Because there is a custom to fast on the wedding day. And that custom happens to be prevalent really only in Ashkenazi circles. But Yosef has a tshuva where he says that among the Sfardim, they did not accept this practice. But it is a very prevalent practice in Ashkenazi circles. So it suggested by Yitzchak that Eliezer was fasting because he was functioning as the Shliach of the commission. So therefore, he was assuming that he should fast also. Caleb?
But he's, even if he's serving as Shliach, he's not the one getting married.
Oh, okay. So we'll get to that. That's definitely relevant. So it's a part of why it's so interesting. So this assumption that he was fasting Torah's Hayas Chatzanim is an interesting suggestion. And a number of Sfarim attacked it. And they said, you can see from the Pesukim that it's not true that he wasn't fasting. How do you know he wasn't fasting? Because we just read in the previous fasting, and this is raised as an objection to maybe his position. So if you know, you've heard of the reputation of Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, he was the great Imam in Tzchus and Klal Yisrael, he was always Jews. So I think we have a chiyuv to try to Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. So I think it's possible to do that. I think we can suggest an interpretation here that will support his job, as interesting as it is, that it's not necessarily a contradiction to say that he was fasting and that he drank water before. And it relates to Caleb's question that here he's functioning as a shliach of kedushin, but not the actual chassan. So, is it so clear that a shliach should fast also? Should we necessarily assume that the fast that applies to a chassan would apply to a shliach of kedushin? So, the truth is that probably goes to the core question of what is this fast about? Why is there a practice to fast on the day of the wedding? So, if you look at the Beis Shmuel on the side of the Shulchan Aruch in Ebenezer, or if you look in the Magen Avraham and Aruch Chaim, which comes up also, it's in Aruch Chaim, there's some discussion about certain days when you would fast. So in both places, the Magen Avraham and the Shmuel, they quote the Maimonides, who has two theories as to why it is that there is this practice to fast on the day of the wedding. There are other theories as well, but these are two main theories. The one theory is a very beautiful idea that the day of the wedding is considered to be like a personal yom kippur. Chazal have in a few places the notion that a chassan on the day he gets married, and he gets a clean slate. And it's an interesting discussion whether that's automatic or not. Is it something that just comes right away, or is it an opportunity to get a mechila? The idea that you would fast because it's kind of a personal yom kippur in reaction to that. So that seems to really be predicated on the idea that it's more of an opportunity. It was just a free amnesty. So then presumably you should fast, you should party. Most people do party on the day of the wedding, but you keep having a fast before it. So why would that be necessary if it just represented a absolute mechila? So this seems to work with the understanding that it's an opportunity, that you have a chance now to start afresh. Maybe because of some explaining, you're taking on the level of responsibility, or you are recreating yourself complete before marriage. So now it's a whole new stage. You have an opportunity to start anew. So therefore, there comes with that a potential mechila kapara. So the idea being that to fast on that day, to take advantage, like it's a personal Yom Kippur, is that you can maximize the potential for this atonement. That's one suggestion. The other suggestion they have is that it's to prevent shichrus, that we're afraid of intoxication. that here there is a need to carry out a procedure with sound mind, that one has to have intent. We spoke a little bit in the context of getting about the parallel with Kiddush, about what kind of das is necessary in terms of what the chassan has to be thinking about, what the kallah has to be thinking about. But the assumption that there is some kind of mental stability that's going to be necessary in order to carry out the kinyan kiddushin. So therefore, we're afraid that it shouldn't be a situation where the chassan is drunk. So if that's the case, so we expand it to say that there's a general ban on all eating to prevent that which would lead to shichras. So these are the two stadim. There are other suggestions as well. And they have various nafkaminas. There's a lot to say about this. But one of the questions that is impacted by this is this issue that's presented here, that does the fast apply to a shaliach as well? Is it only the chassan himself, or should the shliach fast? This was a safek in the Prima Gadim. There's a tshuva about this, and the tshuva is the Sarvis tshuva. Others bring up this issue, that presumably it depends on the two reasons here. That if we were to understand that the issue is you're fasting because of a kapara that comes along with it, so then it really makes sense to say the kapara is only for the chassan himself. So even though he's at home while the shliach is out there doing all the work, but the chassan is the one getting the kapara, so presumably he should fast. And the shliach, there's no reason for him to fast. But if the idea is that when you're carrying out the Maisa Kedushin, the Kenyan Kedushin, that should be done without any questions, so then there could be an argument to say it should be the shliach who should be fasting, and the chassan who's not doing any of that, so he doesn't necessarily have to fast. So if you follow that, it comes out that the whole angle to obligate a shliach the Kedushin and the fast is working off the premise that the purpose of the fast is to avoid drunkenness. So if that's the case, this has a connection to another nafkamina as well. The Aruch HaShulchan writes, and this is a very practical issue because nowadays we often have a lot of questions about fasting the day before the wedding. Sometimes the chassan or the kallah is a little nervous about it, various other kinds of considerations, or where they'll get sick, they're dancing, they're fasting. So is there any leeway here within the minig? And the Aruch HaShulchan points out that if we're talking about a concern of intoxication, so then to have light food, that could be acceptable. And certainly, the Aruch HaShulchan says, to drink water, so that's okay. So if you follow the math here, so it comes out that the same angle to say that a shliach l'kedushin should fast would also allow leniency in terms of drinking water. So what comes out is that we can support the pshat of Levi Yitzchak, the great Malamed Zchus of the Jewish people. We can be Malamed Zchus on him. And we could say that the pshat makes sense, that the whole angle of a shliach l'kedushin should fast is connected to an understanding that would allow him to drink water. Also could say another tzad, there really is a third explanation as to what the nature of the fast is, and that's the view of the Rokeach. The second time mentioning Rokeach this morning, it's not unusual, but the Rokeach understands that the minig is connected to the general idea that you don't eat before you perform a mitzvah. I know, so for example, before blowing shofar, before taking the lulav, you're not supposed to eat significantly. So here, if you have this mitzvah in front of you of getting married, so then you shouldn't eat then as well. And the minig developed along those lines. So that, if that's the case, so then that connects to the question of what exactly is the zman of the fast. In general, that's an issue when you have a wedding, let's say that takes place in the afternoon. So does the fast go for the whole day, even after the chuppah, or does the wedding only go up to the chuppah, or the fast only go up to the chuppah? Or if the wedding is at night, so then maybe you could argue you shouldn't fast during the previous day at all, because it's halachically a different day. So that's not our practice, but that also reflects some of the question here as to what exactly the purpose of the fast is. So, for example, if the purpose of the fast was to prevent drunkenness, so then it would go up until the chuppah.
if that's the middle of the day, and then the fast would stop. And if the fast was for that purpose, then even if the fast, let's say, the wedding is right after Shkia, so then it still makes sense to fast before that, even though it's a separate day. While if the idea is that you're trying to bring about a kapara, so then it's more of a halachic kind of fast, and that might have different parameters to it. So when it comes to this idea of the rokeach, it's a third perspective to say that you should be eating when you have a mitzvah in front of you. So how long is the zman of that mitzvah? When exactly does that kick in that you have the mitzvah in front of you? We had that recent discussion about when dating starts. So should we say that as soon as a person starts dating, so from then until he gets married, he has to fast the whole time because that mitzvah is in front of him. So however many years that it takes, he should fast the entire time. So pretty clear that that's not the case. So presumably we mean that when you're in the zone of doing this, however you define that zone, so at that time, you shouldn't be eating before that. So that also could work with Rav Levi's switch chat, because once he hadn't yet decided who it is who's going to be the kalas, okay, so then he's not in the parsha of fasting. But once this test was over and now he decides that she's the kala and he's ready to bring about the kedushin, so then it makes sense, okay, from that point on, that's when his fast started, and it's not a contradiction that earlier that day he was drinking water. Caleb.
But wouldn't there be, if the point of, according to the Manda Amar, that fasting is when drunkenness, wouldn't there be a nisor on eating that entire day? Because the Chatan and Kala aren't allowed to get drunk. Yes, they have a little bit of wine during Kiddushin and Nisuin, and maybe during the Birkat HaMazon, but they're not, the Chatan and Kala aren't allowed to have wine, so wouldn't the fast, like, wouldn't that impact the fast?
Yeah, it would impact it. I think it would impact in the other direction, though, because first of all, it would be more limited. And so as far as the time, as far as that which is connected to the zone here, and also as far as what's involved. But also, it's not clear. We say they're not allowed to get drunk. So it's not 100% clear exactly what the chash is. This idea that we're concerned about something, it's not an iser shechris per se. It's that we're afraid somehow it's going to affect the process. And how exactly it affects it, what kind of level of das are we concerned about? Not exactly clear, but it seems to play out in the other direction, that if that's the concern, so there's a little bit more leeway in terms of time. It comes more to a practical zone rather than a halachic fast. And also in terms of what's included, so to say, to drink water, for sure, that seems to be very grounded in leniency. And so to work that out, that the pshat that he's suggesting is compatible with that, seems to be a reasonable assumption to make. And there are a few other suggestions as well, the same for Kol Ma'ariv Yitzchak, we've mentioned a few times recently, where he suggests that maybe the fasting is because of a comment in the Shari Tshuva, that one should fast on a day of Tzar when he's concerned about something, that maybe he was concerned that he wouldn't carry out the mission successfully, he still had something to in front of him, and therefore he writes in that context also that probably there's also room to be makbil on drinking water with that kind of a situation. The Magen Avraham derives another halachic detail from here. Again, a lot of eyes on Eliezer and what he teaches us. That he says, we see here from Hilchos Derech Eretz that if the Baal HaBayis puts food in front of you, so you're allowed to eat it. You would normally think that you need him to specifically invite you. And you have to wait for permission, but you see that if it's there, so all the Torah says is it was set in front of him. So otherwise, if he wasn't worried about something, he would have the right to eat it. And the Torah Tzvim has a comment about that also. And he thinks this is a heter specifically for the guest. It doesn't let the Baal HaBayis off the hook that he should be more explicitly inviting. But nonetheless, that's perhaps a lesson to learn. So in the next pasuk, he states, Vayomar, Eved Avraham Anochi. So he says, I am the Eved Avraham. By the way, this is the way he's identified throughout the parsha. He doesn't have a name. He's identified here as Eved or as Ish. So here he introduces himself as Eved. And the Gemara Bava Kamma has an interesting limud from this, where Bava Kamma Tzadi Beis Mid Beis, that if there is some gnai about you, if there is some kind of embarrassing fact about you, so you should be the one to say it first. Now, this correlates well with modern PR advice to say that if there's any kind of a scandal brewing, So then you should try to get in front of it first. You should try to be the one to control the spin. So you should put it out there so you could be the one to dictate the terms. So that's one way to understand this. The Tartamima, he has a much firmer understanding. And he says that the point is that if the other person's going to say it, so they're going to embarrass you. So if you want to save them from the Halbonis Panim, so therefore you should have to come out first and make sure that you're able to save them from that. It's an interesting question to phrase it like that, to get a very firm idea. It's actually not totally incompatible with the PR suggestion, because it's not just who's embarrassing who, but also the level of embarrassment is different if you are the one taking the initiative. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a tshuva where he discusses, it was a suggestion of Rav Shlomo Kluger, it was a psak of Rav Shlomo Kluger that all the later poskim disagreed with. Now, Rav Shlomo Kluger said that the Gemara compares humiliation to death. So what are the implications of that? So Rav Shlomo Kluger writes in his commentary to Shulchan Aruch, really based on a different svara, but making a similar point, that you would not have to embarrass yourself to save somebody else's life. And all the later poskim disagreed with that. There's a great literature about that. And Rav Shlomo Zalman in a tshuva where he talks about this, he explains why he thinks it's not correct. But part of it is, it's Gemara Maseches Tainis that says that embarrassment is very different when it's self-inflicted. So it's one thing if you're embarrassing somebody else, the Gemara says that's like murdering them. But to allow yourself to go through an embarrassing experience, it's not going to have the same kind of impact. And so that's perhaps also what's going on here. It's a combination of the two. So you'll save the other person from the avera, but also it's not going to be as bad. Caleb?
But isn't it wrong to embarrass anyway? Why is that? Person A is going to embarrass person B. So person B should then put themselves out there, let themselves get embarrassed in order to spare person A from doing a sin. Person A is...
It relates to some of our previous discussions, right? Like we were talking about Prusbul. It relates to some of those other issues of just how much do we get involved in order to save others from avaros. So that's a much broader discussion, and it's a very interesting interpretation to say that that's what's going on here, but that's an additional suggestion. There's a lot to concern yourself about how exactly...
You're saving someone else from an avera, but that person is the very person who's trying to hurt him, and the way he's saving himself is by still embarrassing himself.
It's a big act of sacrifice.
What?
Yeah, it's quite a self-sacrifice. So, in any event, it's definitely way lifting the shores of the one would think. It wouldn't necessarily advocate it in every situation. But in any event, so here, the Rav also had a comment about this, that perhaps also another reason why Eliezer is framing it this way is because he wants to make it clear that this is his whole purpose, this is his whole existence, and it's a kilu, isn't anything else. So the next pasuk continues to say, "Hashem berachas adonai ma'od ba'yigdal v'yitin lo tzon v'akar v'chesed v'zav v'avadim v'shvachos v'segmol v'chamorim." So God blessed my master tremendously, and I have a lot. And he starts to tell the whole story. Now, what's going to be noted here is that the story is going to have some differences the way he relates it. He's going to have some differences from what was related in the previous Aliyah. And there's a lot of discussion about this. Rav Shmuel Shneifel Hirsch thought that everything could be explained by politeness, that he didn't want to stun to amaze these people too much with too much extreme material. So the modifications perhaps reflect that, but we'll see a little bit more about that. So he goes on to say, "Vatelet zara eshes adoni bein la adoni achrei diknasa b'itein lo es kala shalom." So here, my master had a son, even when his wife was old, and here he gave him everything. So why is he mentioning that she was old? Does the Paris Yosef know? It seems like it's too much information. Why is that relevant to this? So he thought that this was also a part of what we find. That's discussed, Chazal quote later, Rashi quotes later, that there were people who were trying to spread rumors, Lord Tzanei Hador, who were challenging the whole Yichus of Yitzchak. So here he was trying to emphasize that his whole birth was a nes, and if that's the case, it must be something that a Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted, and is not anything attributed to anything scandalous. So he goes on to continue, we'll just say quickly so we can get a little more in here. So he says that my master made me swear that I shouldn't find a girl from the daughters of Canaan, that's where he lives, but rather he should go back to where his ancestors are from. And so he went back for Omar El Adoni, Ulai Lo Sela Chayish Acharai. So he says, I related to him, Eliezer, that maybe he won't want to come with me. Maybe she won't want to come with me. Maybe the girl won't want to come with me. So that language of Ulai, so Rashi quotes here the idea that he was trying to find maybe it's a problem with this. That he really, Eliezer, wanted to marry Yitzchak off to his own daughter. And Avram said that they're incompatible. And therefore, he was a little frustrated by that. And as the Vilna Gaon points out, that the language of Ulai might be relevant here, because Ulai means actually something that you want to happen. And Pen means something that you don't want to happen, which they translate into English as lest. To be a bad eventuality. And Ulai is something you're maybe hoping for. So the idea that he was saying, maybe she won't come with me, it actually reflects the fact that there's a part of him that was conflicted here, and that maybe wanted that he wouldn't be successful in finding a shidduch for Yitzchak, because maybe that would preserve the opportunity for his own daughter to marry her. So it's interesting then that it's coming up now, and this is discussed in the Re'eim and others, and that the whole notion that Eliezer was not compatible for Avram earlier, because, as Rashi says, Ein Orer Medabek Bebarach, that descendants of Avram are blessed, and Eliezer was on the other side of the equation, but we also are told that he eventually was able to develop this connection to Avram that made him blessed also. So therefore, maybe he was still now maintaining the possibility that maybe there could be a new decision. So he had this conflict, he had this mixed emotion that maybe there might be a still possibility that he could be the one to make the shidduch. So that's perhaps represented with that language. Interesting, because you also find that language when Yaakov goes in to get the bracha from Yitzchak, and he says, Ulai, that maybe he will catch on that he is, that I am not Esav. And that also would be hard to understand in this way, because if Ulai is what he wants, then why is he using that word? Unless we understand that also reflects a conflict, that Yaakov was very torn about what was going on, and the part of him that wanted the truth to come out. Okay, so in any event, to skip a little bit, so we'll have some time here, so we look at Pasuk Mondays. So he says, ויבוא היום על העין, ואומר השם אלוקי אדני אברהם, אם יש חנה מצליח דרכי, אשר אנוכי הולך עליה. So here I came to the well, and I asked Hashem for help. And here in this discussion, he's going into all these details. So Rashi writes that Yofas Yichasin Shalav Yavas Yosim Yitarasin Shalbanim, that we're hearing the whole story twice. And presumably, this doesn't just mean that we're giving it more real estate because we have such respect for the Avos, but also it tells us that there's a lot to learn from every word, that there is great precision that's being invoked here. So to give an example of one detail, it's just how careful the Avos were. So the idea that he came specifically today, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin and Tavtarihei Mir Aleph, that there was the Kfitas Hadarach, that he was able to travel on the same day. And the Torah Tamima suggests that the reason that was mentioned is because he had a Shtar Matana from Avram, and he didn't want it to be post-dated, even though that's acceptable. A post-dated Shtar is acceptable, a predated Shtar is possible, but a post-dated Shtar is acceptable. And nonetheless, it's Mechzik Kishikra, so it has the appearance of not being accurate, and he was so careful about every detail. He wanted to be especially careful about that as well, and therefore he phrased it like this to show that they made sure to be accurate. So he tells them the whole story, and I have to skip for a minute to Pasuk Mem Zayin as he's telling the whole story of the test, so he relates all of that. And then it says, Veshalo Sabi Yomer Bas Miat, Batomer Bas Besuel Ben Nachor, Sheol Belo Milka. Yasim Hanezam Alapav Hatsmidim Al Yadav. So here, these differences in the story. So there is a nice essay about this by Rav Ariel. Rav Ariel, who was a great Talmud Chacham and Eretz Yisrael, who was written many Sfarim, many Tshuvas, and he has a Sefer Al Torah as well, called the Ba'ol HaShel Torah. So he discusses the fact that there are differences in the story and how to explain that. And he discusses it in the context of a fascinating dispute among the Rishonim connected to a Gemara in the Seches Chulin. There's a Gemara in Chulin which has a very surprising suggestion that what Eliezer did with the whole test to ascertain who the Shidduch should be, that somehow was a violation of Nechush, that it was a superstitious act that violated the Torah's prohibition against acting superstitiously. And it's very difficult on many levels, and there's a lot to say about this. But among them, the fact that superstition is when you make your decisions based on something irrational. While what Eliezer did, he was testing for chesed. That's very rational, and that's very logical and understandable, and he set up a test to see if she was kind. So why should Eliezer be accused of nechush? And there's a big machlokus among the Rishonim, how literally to read that Gemara. The Rambam seems to take it at face value and says that the standard for nechush is what Eliezer did. And the Ravid gets very upset about this and says that's not what it means. It doesn't mean that he was in violation of nechush, but it means that the level of commitment that he had, were it something irrational, that would have been nechush. That's how other Rishonim understand it as well. So that's a part of the big machlokas. So in taking all this together, Ariel has a discussion where he notes also there's an idea that Rashi quotes and the Maral expands upon, that the gifts that he had here, the bracelets and the nose rings, so, and all of that has symbolism that represents the Torah and the Avodah, that the bracelets, like the tablets, represent the Torah, and the nose rings were like the Shkalim, that represents the Avodah, and Rivka herself represents Chesed. So together you have the Torah, the Avodah, and the Gemilas Chesedim. But that whole package, as important as the whole set is, but clearly it means Chesed is at the core of everything, because Rivka represents Chesed, so she's clearly the main focus, and everything else is the adornment. So it emphasizes just how much Chesed is the basis for everything. So he goes on to say that this reflects a difference between how the actual facts were and how Eliezer was presenting it. That what Eliezer did, indeed, was not nechush at all. It was totally rational. He was looking for a girl of chesed, and he found a girl of chesed through the system. And it wasn't stam chesed, but her chesed was so extraordinary. The effort she made to take care of him and his camels, which was physically challenging, and she did all that in her own initiative. So that shows it's not simple chesed, but it's an extraordinary chesed, and it was safe to assume there wasn't going to be any other competitors. There wasn't going to be anybody else on that level of chesed. So what he actually did made a lot of sense, and that wasn't nechush. But when he recounts the story with these differences, so he's trying to present it in a way that's going to appeal to Lavan and to the family, in a way that is going to resonate with them. And they are more superstitious. They're looking more for different signs and indications. And therefore, when he tells that, he focuses on details like this. Basmiat, oh, you're from this family, that's exactly who it was supposed to be about. Oh, that's unbelievable. What a coincidence, how could that be? So all of that presentation, which was designed and was shifted, adapted in a way that would resonate with them more, so he suggests that's the nechush kind of presentation. So he suggests that's the interpretation of the machlokes here, that for what he actually did, indeed, the Ravid is right and the other Rishonim are right. Eliezer didn't violate nechush in any real sense. But as far as looking at a model of nechush from Eliezer, not what he actually did, but the way he told the story, that's meant to evoke that kind of a reaction. And that's why Chazal used it as a symbol, as an indication. Very interesting. So we'll just mention one more idea and we'll wrap up here. But here, the line that resonates very strongly, Vayam Lav and Abisuel, Vayomer Me Hashem Yotza Hadavar. Wow, this is amazing. We can't say anything about this. And clearly, this all comes from God. And the Gemara in Ma'ikat, and then that Piches Mubez, relates that we see here that Shiduchim are from Hashem. We see here that it needs Siyata Deshmaya and the Torah Tzmima comments that the point is that it's so difficult, it's so challenging that HaKadosh Baruch Hu not only has to help, but he is Mesiachis, his name to it. And that's reflected in this statement even coming from the mouth of Rabban and Besuo, that the recognition that God is behind it and that God is associated with it, and that's a source both of hope and confidence in the very tricky parsha of Shiduchim. So many, many fascinating ideas emerging from the whole parsha, but even just from this aliyah, so much to reflect upon. And hopefully that should give us some additional inspiration as we ponder this very complex and involved parsha of the Shabbos. And I wish all of you a wonderful Shabbos. It should be only good things, and I look forward to connecting with you on Sunday. Have a terrific Shabbos.
Thank you.